In this part of Focus 580, we'll be looking at the way that we talk about the free market. It seems that these days, praise for the free market has become a standard part of political speechmaking, virtually for any politician, or at least for many, on both sides of the political spectrum. However, our guest this morning, in this hour, says that that's rather curious, given the fact that there's so little evidence that the free market system has been successful, at least for a lot of people. Our guest for the program is James Onney. He's professor of speech communications at Penn State University and has authored a book that's titled Selling the Free Market, The Rhetoric of Economic Correctness, looking at the way in which we talk about economics, express enthusiasm for the free market system, who benefits and who doesn't, and how it is that it would seem people have been led to vote and act against their interests. The book is published by Guilford Press. It's out now in bookstores if you'd like to look at it. Our guest, in addition to teaching at Penn State, has also taught at Tulane, University of Virginia, University of St. Thomas, and also Texas A&M. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And, of course, as we talk, your questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us. And so if it's a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Onney, hello.
Hello, David. It's good to be here.
And I hope, by the way, I am pronouncing your name correctly.
You're pronouncing it correctly. Almost no one ever gets it right.
All right. Well, we try to be careful with things like that. We certainly have talked about these issues before, and I'm certain that the people that we've talked with on other programs have been economists, political scientists. And I guess what intrigued us about having this conversation with you was the idea that perhaps the take would be a little bit different because of the discipline that you come from, because you're not an economist. As a person who is interested in rhetoric, in language, in how we talk about things, in persuasive speech, how is it that you become interested in this economic topic?
What I've discovered, I think like everybody else, is that so much of our everyday talk seems to center on economic questions. I even hear professors comparing their retirement stock portfolios over coffee during the day. And it seems as though the main standard we use to vote for public figures is whether or not the economy is up or down. And in a democracy, we certainly need to rely on the advice of experts, but there comes a point at which the average citizen needs to be able to talk about economic issues as well. And it's that point where the experts meet the public that's what interests me and what I study as a teacher of rhetoric.
Well, let's get right to the subject of how it is that we talk about economics, and maybe it's not just one should be specific and look at the way, as you do, the way politicians, policy people talk about economics and what that has to do with how generally people think about this idea of the market.
For about the last 25 years, there's been a really big shift in the way that the politicians generally and then us, the public, talk about economic questions, because we have heard the same message, and it's a very simple message, and when messages are simple, we tend to retain them better. And the message goes something like this. Markets always work. They're efficient. They give people what they want. Government is always bad. It's inefficient, bureaucratic, doesn't work. And if you repeat that often enough, it kind of begins to sink in. Now, the message has been there, but we also need to recognize that messages don't come out of thin air. Messages often get paid for. And the evidence is pretty strong that in the last 10 or 15 years particularly, there's been an awful lot of money thrown by conservative foundations into colleges and universities and into funding people to go on the air to talk about economic questions from a very anti-government, pro-unregulated free market point of view. The Center for Responsive Philanthropy in Washington, D.C. issued two reports in the late 1990s that documented that foundations like the Olin Foundation and the Scaife Foundation had donated about $1 billion to a number of universities to fund chairs in free enterprise, to pay law students to take courses in free market ideology and courses called law and economics. And this struck me as very strange, because it was during the 90s that, if you listened to a lot of news stories, you would have thought that somehow the far left had taken control of colleges and universities and was turning everybody into, I don't know, I guess some kind of Stalinist thought control camps.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I was thinking the precisely the same thing, that there would have been a time when, and maybe still now, people would have said the only place that you're going to find any Marxist anymore are, well, other than perhaps North Korea, would be on whatever's the college campus closest to you.
Oh, that's a standard argument that Rush Limbaugh and others make. I think we have to distinguish, though, between Marxists of the Stalin variety or the Soviet Union and longstanding traditions. They're very American traditions. We're all speaking from downstate Illinois at this point, which was a hotbed of populism at the turn of the century. My Norwegian immigrant grandparents, who were populists and socialists, read a little bit of Marx, but they weren't Marxist in that sort of ideological sense. And what we're talking about here is not markets are always bad. If we learn something from the fall of the Soviet Union, we learned that markets are important, useful things. They give us information about prices and things like that. But it's the proper balance between what government can do and what markets can do that it seems to me we've lost in our public discourse in the last 20 years, and that's what I'm interested in looking at here. Mm.
We do have a caller. It's someone that I've been keeping waiting here, and I think I want to get to them because they're on a cell phone rather than not make them wait.
Sure.
Line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. First of all, I wanted to let you know that I read your book probably within the first week that it came out, and it's a really superb book. It's just very well written. And I say that as a former student of Murray Rothbard, part of his cadre of anarcho-capitalists. So I'm definitely a free market person. The one thing which I just wanted to point out, because I'm sure you're going to be getting phone calls which will reflect people's economic and political leanings, is that we have to be careful, and you just were, for example, in discussing a Marxist and a communist view, that when most people talk about capitalism, they're talking about a form of state capitalism and certainly not free market capitalism. So that, for example, in the recent discussion about the market as energy costs in California, and they talk about deregulation, that was in no sense a free market in energy. And the only other point I wanted to make is that there are people who are pro-capitalist not for utilitarian purposes or utilitarian reasons or utilitarian arguments, but who take it as something that comes from the ethics of individualism. And so that's a different sort of an argument, and you basically deal with utilitarian arguments. But I did want to tell you the book, for someone who completely disagrees with most of what you said, is just really good writing, and I think people who are pro-free market would benefit a lot from reading your book. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for the call. Any comment you want to make on that, Professor Ani?
Thank you. Yes, it's important to remember that very strong pro-marketeers do so from different standpoints, and some do it from the very scientific rhetoric of economics, and then others do it within the Rothbard tradition, what some people call these days paleo-libertarianism. And Rothbard was a fascinating man who I think was a very, very creative thinker, who, as the caller said, did approach capitalism from a strictly moral standpoint. He didn't do it by drawing supply and demand curves, but had a faith that I personally don't have, that individuals left to their own devices will tend to do the right thing if the state isn't around there to help them. But yeah, that's a very important distinction to remember. My frustration has mostly been with people different from Rothbard, that is, academic economists who draw a supply and demand curve on the board with just two variables and then profess to have demonstrated scientifically, mind you, that every time you raise the minimum wage, you create unemployment. Every time you organize a union, you throw people out of work. And it's that kind of rhetoric of scientific authority that economists use that is really my main focus. Rothbard is a fascinating man.
Our guest, James Onney, is Associate Professor of Speech Communication at the Pennsylvania State University and is author of a book, and I'll mention again, if you're interested in reading it, it's titled Selling the Free Market. The subtitle is The Rhetoric of Economic Correctness. It's published by the Guilford Press. It should be available in the library or the bookstore. And your questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Sometimes I think that when people think about capitalism, to the extent that they think of it much at all, they have in mind some ideal, simple, one-to-one transaction that maybe we once did things like this, but we certainly don't do it anymore, the kind of thing where you have something and I want it, and so you and I decide, you know, you decide what it's worth to you and I decide what it's worth to me, and if we can work out a transaction, fine, and if I decide that you want more than I'm willing to pay, then I just say, okay, well, thanks very much. And I go down the road and find somebody else who will do it on the terms that I want. And then, you know, that may be in the abstract. It's nice to think about it that way. But it seems that in the world, things don't work that way. And yet the way that we think about it somehow doesn't square with the reality of it.
No, it certainly doesn't. If you read Adam Smith, kind of the father of modern economics, you know, you get these kind of tales of two people in the woods exchanging so many deer for so many beaver, and mm-hmm. it looks so perfect. And that really still happens today. It's like, I don't know if Champaign-Urbana has had the living wage campaign that some communities have had that have tried to set a minimum wage above the federally established minimum. But when communities do that, inevitably they can get a lot of hired gun economists to come in and say that it's proven that the minimum wage causes unemployment. And the trouble is that it does that if you only isolate two variables, the cost of labor and the quantity of labor demanded. And sure, if you raise the price of something, perhaps sometimes people don't buy as much of it, but there are too many other variables that come in, such as your example of kind of two people meeting each other to engage in a transaction is a perfect one, because it presumes that those two people are equal. If I want to go out and get a job, or anyone really listening to this program is on the job market, we don't always bring the same level of power and resources that our employers do. And it was to equalize out those market relationships that we got things like minimum wage laws or workers' compensation or occupational safety and health legislation, all things that among libertarians of many varieties are really kind of on the chopping block right now, that if we believe government never works, all we really need to do is get back to this pure system where buyers and sellers meet each other. Bill Gates, in his book, The Road Ahead, calls this the ideal of frictionless capitalism, which he believes the Internet is bringing us towards. But if there's a big power differential between Bill Gates and probably most people listening to this program that such models don't account for.
This, I'm interested, maybe you might talk a little bit more about the development of this now rather commonly held idea that the government never works. Certainly there, and one doesn't want to make blanket statements, but and there may be places where the government doesn't do as well as it could, and yet there are certainly other places where it seems government works pretty well, and we have strong commitments to large government programs like Social Security, for example, that probably is the most popular government program going, and one that nowadays there's a lot of rhetoric and a lot of ink spilled about how we need to make sure this program continues. You know, how is it that we can hold to this idea that says, well, government never works, when we can go out and find examples, if we tried, and it wouldn't be too tough, to find examples of when, in fact, we could say the government does work, and people would, if we started asking people about them, they'd say, well, yeah, okay, that one. But the rest of the time, no.
Now, I remember a couple years ago, James Carville decided to do a survey of conservative pundits to get them to list the government programs they thought were good things. And the conservative pundits didn't have a lot of trouble coming up with their list. It included things like the GI Bill, Some said Social Security. Some said the Tennessee Valley Authority. There are a host of them. And part of my interest has been into trying to figure out how the message has gotten repeated over and over again, government doesn't work. Your mentioning of Social Security, I think, is a great example, because if someone had just been listening to the news in the last 5 years, you would think that you were probably going to get $50 a month when you retired on Social Security. I don't know if you got this, but last summer, for the first time, I got a mailing from the Social Security Administration that kind of projected, based on my current earnings or what I had paid in, what I would likely get when I retired. Mm-hmm. And I remember being really shocked. I've been working full-time for about 20 years, and I thought, you know, this really isn't too bad. I mean, it probably was not enough for me to live on, and I'm glad I also have my retirement fund that colleges and universities provide. But you would think that the Social Security was nothing. And the trouble is that not only are there programs that, in fact, work quite well, such as the one I've listed, but in those cases where privatization has taken place, the result hasn't really been all that great. Here's just a couple of examples that those of us who live in small towns, I'm sure, know what it's like dealing with airline service these days, or even people, I guess, flying between big cities. Deregulation after the 1970s hurt small towns, and the service is terrible. Long-distance phone rates dropped for people who make a lot of long-distance phone calls, but local phone rates since deregulation of the telephone industry have increased like 50 to 60%, which is harmful to a low-income family. I remember in the 70s, when I didn't have any money going through graduate school, I could get local phone service for about $4 a month. It was a party line, but that didn't bother me too much. If I could even decipher my monthly phone bill now, I'm not even sure I could tell you what my basic service is. But probably the biggest example, the one that's affected us probably most directly, was in 1983, when interest rate ceilings were lifted as part of a general bank deregulation, that the net effect of that was this speculative mania that went on among the savings and loan industry, some of which was one of George Bush's sons was involved in, as a matter of fact. And by 1992, the bill for taxpayers was around $200 billion to bail out the costs of that very expensive experiment in deregulation. So the record really isn't that good, and the same thing is true with the proposals for Social Security. I imagine that people who were thinking about privatization started getting a little nervous last quarter when they got their quarterly statement about their retirement funds or stocks that they might hold, because I began to realize that you just have one bad quarter, you begin to realize that there's something nice and stable about Social Security, knowing that it'll be there.
It seems that only recently have we begun to hear some significant criticism of the concept of deregulation, and mostly, I think, in connection with electric utilities and airlines, although there's, I think, reason to also look at other sectors of the economy have been deregulated and look at the promises that were made about the fact that it was said that deregulation would lead to more service, not less, more providers, not fewer. It would be good for consumers. We would end up paying less for those things. And I can't think of, maybe you can or somebody else can, I guess I can't think of anything in which that's actually turned out to be the case. And yet at the same time, as I say, seems that only recently, and because of what's been going on in California, and because people have had a bad time at the airport, does it seem now, do we have very much questioning about the whole idea of deregulation and whether or not it's good or bad?
Yeah, I think we really are at a kind of crucial turning point. People have anxiety about their jobs, the idea that a company had responsibility to you for pretty much your whole life, if you gave them years of service, is gone. Our experience with deregulated utilities. The earlier caller talked about not using the California example as a case of a pure free market, and he's certainly right about that. But I was thinking of the other example. I was trying to think, because I usually do try to be fair, to try to think of an example of where deregulation hasn't been a disaster. And to some extent, electricity deregulation in the Northeast has been a little bit successful. I live in Pennsylvania, which is deregulated. But the big difference from California is that Pennsylvania has banded together with about five other states and has used the kind of market power that they have in that consortium of states to lock in certain kinds of rates with the utilities. And so, at least thus far, I'm crossing my fingers, we're told we shouldn't have the problems California is having. But then I've been asking people, well, I haven't lived in Pennsylvania that long. I've been asking people, well, has it really made that much of a difference in your utility rates? And the last news report I heard said something like there's maybe been about $18 worth of savings every month. And I guess, you know, $18 doesn't sound like a whole heck of a lot of money to me, and I think I'd rather bank on the long-term stability you have with a regulated utility over against having $18 more in my pocket. But I'm one for stability, I guess.
We have some other callers. Again, a cell phone, so we'll get to that person on line four. Hello.
Hi. I was, I think your point is well taken, and I'd like to congratulate you coming out and talking about it, because the idea that competitive forces always bring prices down, that kind of a myth is, and if people go around and check prices in the airlines and things like that, you'll often find that, or whatever business, that there seems to be a certain level, and it doesn't get maybe 15% above or below that level, and the market is not competing in many circumstances between each other as far as a particular business. They're sometimes, in essence, they're really competing against other where the consumer will spend their money. And they know that they can only get so much from this particular area. But I just wanted to hear what you had to say about competition-lowering prices and what validity that do they have or not have. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I had been searching for the argument in my head earlier when we were talking, when David was talking about that kind of pure model of the buyer and selling meet each other, and I think your question brings up the point I was looking for, which is that what happens when you don't have, when you've just got a few sellers out there, when you have things that are very much like monopolies, or people are able to fix prices, whether through collusion or just by watching each other's behavior. I think probably good example of this for those of you who have children of college age is to sort of look at the college education market. You know, a few years ago they discovered that the Ivy League schools were basically price fixing the costs of college education, and colleges don't vary terribly widely in their costs, at least private versus public, and even the public costs are going up all the time. And so it's that question of market power. What happens when you enter the market? Now, there are some times when, you know, the buyer has a lot of power. If you have several people in your town who are selling appliances, and, you know, more competition does tend to be good for the consumer at some point. But what happens when that dwindles to very few? And another part of this radical free market rhetoric that's sunk in the last 20 years is that there's even been a shift among some of the mainstream conservative economists away from believing in antitrust. Old-fashioned, laissez-faire folks like Rothbard and others were believed very strongly in competition. But Chicago School economists, some of the people who teach law and economics, for instance, I'm thinking of Robert Bork, who, before he became famous for his ill-starred attempt to be appointed to the Supreme Court, made his name as a scholar of antitrust. And Bork, like other Chicago School-trained economists, believed that there's really no point in having antitrust legislation anymore, because over the long run, the market will correct for somebody who has way too much power, such as Microsoft, for example. And again, you wonder if sometimes we just don't get ideas because somebody paid for them very handsomely. Robert Bork now makes about $500,000 a year as a paid intellectual by one of these conservative think tanks in Washington. And so I guess there's money to be made out there. I've sometimes thought that as I try to pay the bills every month, I should wake up some morning and really become a conservative. I could do a heck of a lot better financially.
Well, I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go to line number one in Urbana. Hello?
Yeah, I think the dirty little secret of Bush-style free enterprise is that they'll do anything to fix the market. That's their idea of a free market. Anything from professional monopolies to deregulation of natural monopolies. I mean, what they're really after is fixing the market. They're not really talking about free enterprise. They're talking about a skewed market where they're essentially supremacists, and whoever they want their side, they have extra power. You know, and anything that gives them that extra power is fine with them. I think they signaled as much in their consent to what California has gone through, because it's only the federal government that could have made those out-of-state energy producers toe the line, just the way Kennedy made the steel producers toe the line back in the 60s. So I guess my question is, since you're into rhetoric, I'm wondering how do you explain such a lack of rhetoric around, you know, the truth of what's going on? How can you explain that, or how do you, to your students, for example?
That's a terrific question. A part of me thinks that sometimes the American left has a kind of death wish, that there's a tendency sometimes to focus on questions that are often far distant from the concerns of working families. I talked a bit about economic correctness before, but, you know, I've been in a university now for about 20 years, and there were some times in the 90s when I began to wonder if I had to be sensitive one more time and say the right word one more time, that I was going to go out and vote for the next Republican I saw. And I figured if I was feeling like that, people who were considerably to the right of me were probably feeling it. So some of it is that there's been far too much fragmentation, sometimes along the lines of identity politics, sometimes along the lines of focusing on foreign affairs questions as opposed to domestic ones. So some of the criticism, I think, has to be laid at the left itself. But I think another part of it is the failure, to some degree, of our educational system, that we don't train students, or we don't educate students to be citizens anymore. Even in colleges and universities, the primary aim seems to be to try to find the major that'll make you the most money. And the liberal arts often kind of tend to be the poor cousins. It's kind of the way that public radio is in comparison, say, to commercial radio. Where do we go to hear different points of view? Where do we learn to debate? My immigrant grandparents, who came here from Norway around the turn of the last century, had very strong opinions and were able to debate complicated questions like the gold standard or free silver or the formation of the Federal Reserve. And there are a lot of college-educated people who remember that mind-numbing semester they spent with supply-demand curves in economics and wondered what relationship it had to the real world. And so I think it is that we've let a kind of rhetoric of scientific authority frighten even ordinary educated people away from arguing about economic questions. And in a way, that was kind of the risk I decided to take in writing this book, was here's somebody who doesn't have a degree in economics, trying to make some sense out of these in the public framework. And so I will see whether or not the risk completely pays off or not. But I think it's partially education, partially because there hasn't been a strong unified voice that has said, wait a minute, markets can't do everything. There is a role for government to fill in where markets don't work so well, to set conditions, to create infrastructures. You know, the best example, I think, is probably the Internet itself. here is something that is now, I think, being a lot of people who work in the computer industry are supposedly, I guess the term is cyber libertarians, but the reality is that we wouldn't have gotten the Internet for all of its pluses and minuses without one of the hugest government investments in history. This came out of a Defense Department project, after all.
Yeah, I'll look for that to be, that loophole to be plugged pretty quick, I would guess, because basically we're just trying to seduce ourselves into what, to my mind, is just piracy. Thank you.
All right, we're a little bit past the midpoint, or fairly significantly past the midpoint of the program, talking with James Onney. He's professor of speech communication at Penn State. And if you look for his book, by the way, which is titled Selling the Free Market, his last name spelled A-U-N-E. The book is published by Guilford Press in the bookstore now. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. And if you are making a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Next up is a caller in Lafayette, Indiana, and this is line two. Hello.
Hi. I appreciate you taking the call. I had this is kind of interesting. I'm reading a book by a guest I think has been on this program before, Robert McChesney, and he talks about media consolidation and a little bit about deregulation in the media industry. And one of the things that he brings up in his book, and I think that you've sort of talked about a little bit before already, is the notion of accountability and the notion that the markets, it's difficult for a free market to have accountability to the average consumer. And I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit.
Yeah, supposedly the arguments by the pure free marketeers is that markets are always responsive. I think if we were to look at this as a kind of language strategy, if you were to take the terms market, the people, and government and put them side by side, what I think you'd probably see is that in people's heads in the last 10 years or so, the market seems closer to the people in folks' minds, whereas people and government seem to be further away in semantic space. That's kind of an abstract answer to your question, but what I'm trying to get at here is that it used to be the case that we thought of the government as responsive to the people. The will of the people is a term that comes out over and over again in the founding documents of our republic, but we seem to have become convinced that government is never responsive, while markets always are. Now, I don't know about you. I hate to pick one example, but let's say a prominent software manufacturer who manufactures the most widely used program on computers. If you've had problems with that software program, I've had a terrible time trying to get advice from the company that manufactures it, largely because they've got so much market share that they can completely avoid paying any attention to me as a consumer.
That old Lily Tomlin line, we're the phone company, we don't care, we don't have to.
That's absolutely right. There comes a certain amount of concentration, and there's no responsiveness at all.
Okay. Well, thank you for your comments.
All right. Thanks. But I think it's interesting that here is a case where the idea that markets don't always work, but this idea that in particular industries or particular areas of the economy, that market share, it gets to the point where if you're so dominant, then you might as well forget the idea of markets. That's still something that within economics is a really radical concept. And as clear an example as that seems to be, it doesn't seem to be enough for some people to get them even to question the idea of the market.
No, there are a couple of really good examples of that. I don't know if you remember back to the days of Betamax versus VHS.
Oh, I still have one.
My wife happens to be someone who tends to study television and the mass media. And when she started her graduate work, she invested in a couple of Beta machines, mm-hmm. because everybody said, you know, this is higher, better resolution. These are, it's just, I don't know much about it, but the idea was that this is really a better product. But Beta always had too much small market share. I've been accused by people of being a Macintosh cultist, but I think the hardware for computers is a good example as well. that it, can you imagine anybody knocking off Microsoft or the PC system, Windows, at this point, simply because they've already got so much market share that I've heard people who say, well, I guess I'm going to have to buy a PC instead of a Mac because there just aren't enough people writing software now for the Macintosh. And that seems like such a clear example of where a consumer's demand is really not being met simply because of the existing power people have in the market.
Just another point that you address is perhaps the way that we think about what rhetoric or persuasive speech is, that we have this idea, or I guess some people would have the idea, that what it is, it's an appeal to the intellect. You're trying to marshal a series of arguments and that you'll present them to the person and they'll examine them and they'll say, yes, I see that, I see how that all works out, and that's the way that you'll get them to look at things a particular way. It seems to be the case, and it may be actually more common in when you're trying to persuade something, that that here we're not appealing to people's intellects at all. We're actually appealing to their emotions, because if their intellects got engaged, then they might say, now, wait a minute. They might start examining in some of the assumptions and say, well, this doesn't really square up with what seems to be the case. But that doesn't seem to be what's going on. There seems to be some sort of a more gut-level appeal, and that seems to be successful.
It certainly does. I wouldn't want to draw too rigid a distinction between engaging our intellect and our emotions, just because I think that both have a place when we make decisions. I mean, I think if you have an emotional response, say to genocide, for example, that that's a perfectly rational response, even if it engages your heart and your gut, to use our typical metaphors. I'm kind of beginning to think that it's a matter of who has the better story. You know, one of the reasons people always said that Ronald Reagan was such a successful advocate, and I don't know if you noticed the poll this month that placed him right at the top of the greatest presidents in the survey. And some people, I think, attribute Reagan's persuasive ability to his ability to tell a story about America and where it was going that was appealing to folks, largely because it was so optimistic. I don't think that's in and of itself a bad thing. Stories are good things. Optimism is a good thing. I'm actually feeling more optimistic myself these days politically than I have in a long time. But unless you link that with the kind of reality testing that we do when we check out evidence, when we make sure that people are actually consistent in what they say, then there are going to be some problems. But that's why I teach and write what I do, is that I think everybody needs to go through school or in their adult lives, learn how to evaluate public arguments, both for the evidence and for the stories that they're told.
Hmm. Well, I'm now curious to follow up on your comment that where you said actually that you're feeling rather optimistic, or some growing optimism here. This is a time when I would expect a lot of people who were on the left side of things politically would not, or would find it difficult to find reason to be optimistic. Why is it that you are optimistic?
I'm optimistic for a couple of reasons. Certainly one that we can't forget is that the person occupying the White House was not elected by a majority of American citizens. The other is that, you know, during the 1980s and certainly in the 1994 congressional elections, which seemed like such a terrible defeat for the center and for the left with the Newt Gingrich Republicans, that what seems to happen now is increasing fragmentation among conservatives, that the news stories this week about this tremendous infighting between McCain and Bush are, I guess, taking on quite epic proportions in the Congress. There's an ongoing battle between libertarians and social conservatives in the Republican Party. And I think what people who are in the middle or on the left need to figure out how to do is to exploit those very real fractures that are out there. I've one of the reasons I decided to write this book was that it seemed like so many people in academe were most frightened of the Christian social conservatives. And I can't say that I like the Christian social conservatives, but they actually frighten me less in some ways than libertarians do, because social conservatives have had much less influence on policy directly. But if you really put someone like your average Christian conservative next to a Cato Institute libertarian, they have almost nothing in common, either culturally or in terms of policy. And I think that when people out there begin to start to recognize that their conservative instincts, their desire to preserve their families and their neighborhoods and their traditional culture, that one of the biggest threats to those things is an unregulated free market, then I'm crossing my fingers, I guess, that some of those traditionalists might see a role again for government to play. Hmm.
Let's take at least one more caller here, Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. In explaining the persistence of this propaganda about the free market, I refer you to Goebbels, who said, "Repeat the biggest lie long enough and often enough and loudly enough, and people will believe anything."
That was the example I had in my mind when I was saying, "Be simple and keep repeating it." I didn't want to quite put the libertarians in the rank of Goebbels, but yes, that's absolutely the lesson of modern propaganda. Find a simple message, keep repeating it, and that's the one we've heard. Market is good, government is bad.
Well, basically, I put these free marketeers, considering all their other views, where they disregard the rights, the human rights of the individual, in the same boat with the Nazis, ultimately.
There certainly is a willingness among the free marketeers to really discount, say, the sick or the retarded or the aged. You know, one of the chapters in my book is about Ayn Rand, who's kind of the patron saint of a lot of libertarians, from Alan Greenspan to lots of other people. And, you know, if you carefully read Atlas Shrugged, her most famous novel, you know, basically at the end of the novel, you've got millions or billions of people all around the world dying. And her kind of Nazi-like strong intellectual figures are marching out of the wreckage to create their new society. And, in fact, it was Whitaker Chambers who compared Ayn Rand to Nazism in some ways. So maybe you're not so far off.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have a couple minutes left here. I'm going back to just your comments about what's going on within the Republican Party. I think we've heard a little bit less about this, but certainly in the run up to the election, perhaps when the primaries were still going on, there were a lot of people who were looking at what was going on with the Republicans and what Governor Bush was doing, and drawing some comparisons between that and what President Clinton had done with the Democrats and the party, and somehow managing to marginalize the people who were most on the left, drag the party back towards the middle, and put together enough support to get himself elected. I think that some people who would suggest that the Republicans did the same thing. Perhaps the reason that so many people decided to support Governor Bush was they thought he was the guy who could essentially do the same thing. And that for that reason, that what's happened is the people who are more on the right have been somewhat marginalized. He certainly nodded to them in their issues, but it seems that where he's put his most of his importance is with the fiscal conservatives, not so much with the cultural conservatives, and that indeed has had some influence also on how people broadly think in this country.
Speaking as someone who lived in Texas for several years, I've been really mystified by the transformation that Governor Bush went through when he went national. I mean, here was someone who, for all practical purposes, is indistinguishable from the Christian right and his lot of his beliefs, who was suddenly marketing himself as a moderate. I think it's because the political spectrum in Texas is so weird compared with the rest of the United States that a Democrat in Texas is probably like, say, a liberal Republican in Illinois. I'm not sure I quite read the current administration in the way you just did, as far as putting the fiscal conservatives in power. Because if, in fact, George W. Bush were a fiscal conservative, he wouldn't be looking for a $1 trillion tax cut at this point. Bush, before the before he was elected, allegedly president, said that we needed to have tax cuts because basically the federal government didn't deserve our money. It's kind of that message of government doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, in January, where he's trying to do the best to convince us that we're going into a recession, he's all of a sudden talking like a Keynesian again. The idea that if you prime the pump and use fiscal policy to release money to the hands of the wealthy, that you will all of a sudden have economic growth again. So it's not entirely clear to me exactly what Bush believes. His top economic advisor, whose name is Larry Lindsay, is really the last of the major economists who's a supply-sider. Lindsay believes that the Reagan supply-side program worked, and so that's anything but fiscal conservatism.
Well, I'm afraid that we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. We want to say, Professor Anning, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
We're talking with us, our guest, James Anning. He's professor of speech communications at Penn State, and his book is titled Selling the Free Market, The Rhetoric of Economic Correctness. If you go looking for the book, his last name is spelled A-U-N-E, and it's published by the Guilford Press.